Welcome to The Clever Cookster, your ultimate window into the kitchens of the world's best cooks. I'm your host, Kara Rhoda. We are so lucky to have as our guest today the award-winning cookbook writer Nigella Lawson, here to talk about her new book, Simply Nigella, out now from our sister company, Flatiron Books. Welcome.
Thank you.
This episode of Clever Cookster is brought to you by Carnivore Club, the subscription service that brings exceptional quality cured meats to your door made by America's most talented artisans. Carnivore Club is an amazing gift for your meat-loving spouse, family member, or coworker. The number of boxes you wish to gift can be customized. Select a single box for Cousin Vinny to 12 glorious months of Carnivore Club to your beloved. Get unique finds like bison jerky, venison, and wild boar salami, alongside classics like Berkshire prosciutto, all made by independent American craftsmen. This month's feature is California's Angel Salumi, and you can get $10 off a gift or subscription when you enter the promo code CLEVER at checkout. Visit www.carnivoreclub.co to give the best gift to the discerning meat lover in your life. You've written cookbooks that have truly changed people's relationships to cooking, beginning with How to Eat and How to Be a Domestic Goddess. How does the new book, Simply Nigella, reflect the evolution of both your own and maybe our cultural approach to food?
I feel that this book has a part of each book in it. I mean, in many senses, I think it is a continuation from How to Eat, in the sense that it's a reflection on the way I've cooked in my life and how I cook now, because there is quite an emphasis too, at least one whole big chapter on baking. I think there's a bit of How to Be a Domestic Goddess, and I suppose it also because I am talking quite a bit in this book about how cooking itself provides comfort. And the subtitle of Domestic Goddess was Baking and the Art of Comfort Cooking. And I felt that people talked about comfort eating a lot, but they didn't talk about comfort cooking. And for me, this whole book is about comfort cooking. I mean comfort cooking not in a cocooning sense, but very much in the way that I feel that cooking adds to the quality of life immensely. And the subtitle of Simply Nigella is Feel Good Food. And for me, it's incredibly important that food makes me feel good, not just when I eat it, but when I cook it. And I suppose this is an exploration of the many ways these double pleasures can be attained. And simply, you know.
What is it that people find so stressful about cooking?
The thing is that the reason why most people find cooking stressful is because they attempt complicated food. And if I had to try and cook from a restaurant recipe, I too would feel stressed and I wouldn't be able to relax in the moment because I would know that I had to have my eye on about three different pots and pans bubbling away on the stove. And I might even be being required to get a sugar thermometer out, and I might be thinking, what am I doing next and how do I know whether I've done it right? And there would be so much activity to look forward to or to dread, however you want to see it. Whereas if you cook simply, the chances are you really will enjoy being in the kitchen. I do. And I think that actually sometimes people think cooking itself is so much more complicated than it is. As far as I'm concerned, cooking often really just involves a bit of stirring, you know, a bit of stirring and maybe a small bit of chopping. And I don't chop well. I don't chop in a virtuoso way like a chef. And even on days when I think I can't quite face it because I'm tired or I'm bad-tempered, once I get into the kitchen and I'm chopping a carrot or maybe a leek, I don't often do an onion if things are really tense. I might do a shallot. But if I'm just chopping in that sort of way, just I have to slow down. And in having to slow down, that sort of mania of the work week falls away slightly.
I love that idea that comfort food is not just comforting for the person eating it, but for the person making it. One of the things that I love so much about this new cookbook is the concept of bowl food. Tell us about that.
I came up with a chapter called Bowl Food just because I knew I had to have a chapter that represented the way I eat so predominantly. When I think about it now, I think it's no accident that bowl food rhymes with soul food, because I think when I eat food out of a bowl, I feel that it is eating and cooking without any of the fripperies or complications, that it's perhaps even infantile. And in that sense, I feel that sometimes When I talk about soul food, I'm often referring to the food I ate as a child, or an idealized version of the food I ate as a child. And bowl food has that same childlike quality, which is every spoonful or forkful is the same as the one before. There are some days when you want the exciting challenge of that every forkful is going to be slightly different. You have your knife and your fork and you're at creating these exciting permutations. But when I think of bowl food, I think I'm on the sofa and I've just, well, let's not put too fine a point on it, shoveling food into my mouth and just feeling, there is nothing else I'd rather be doing right now. This is just what I need. And actually, you know, I try and avoid going into too much sort of new age speak, but I do feel that holding a bowl, you know, with my two hands gives me a kind of zen-like feeling of peace.
You write often about what's usually called quote-unquote entertaining, but is really about how at home and happy it's possible to make another person feel just by feeding them. As more and more of our friends and family have different dietary needs and nutritional considerations, how do you continue to make everyone feel welcomed and well-fed?
I think as I've got older, I've become more tolerant of people's fads. When I was younger, I used to think, well, you know, I'm just cooking you one meal. You're not going to starve if you can't eat X, Y, or Z, whatever it is that someone can't eat. But actually, if I invite people into my house, really, I want to make them feel welcome. And it doesn't make people feel welcome if they've got to sit and stare at food they can't eat. And actually, for a cook, it's quite exciting to be presented with a challenge. And one of the recipes that I'm particularly in love with, in a way, in this book, is my dark and sumptuous chocolate cake, which is a vegan cake. And I had a friend coming over from New York who's vegan, and I wanted to give a dinner for him. But I don't like having any sort of eating apartheid. So I did a vegan feast. And the hardest thing for me was coming up with a dessert. But I did. And actually, I love this cake so much, and it's so simple. I don't know how it works, but it does. I'm not a food technician. That I've cooked it for every family birthday ever since, and my family aren't vegans. So I suppose that for me, selfishly, I think, cooking for people with restricted diets can be quite exciting because I'm forced to think in a slightly different way so I can get creative.
So it's maybe about finding those recipes that transcend being vegan or gluten-free and are just really, really good.
Well, I think that's true of all sorts of cooking, but I suppose what it is that in life, the thing about making connections, it's at the core of any studying or intellectual research, but it's also absolutely central to our relationships with other people. And when you sit down with other people, often what you're trying to do is find some common ground, somewhere where you can meet. And the same is true when you cook for people who eat different foods and have different restrictions, is that I think, well, where can I find a place in the kitchen that everyone can meet that will please everyone? I don't mean please everyone. No recipe has universal appeal, but at least everyone can feel equally welcomed. I mean, it's always a miracle when you think how different people's palettes are. And the more we learn about, I think it's called neurogastronomy, that it's a miracle that actually any three people can sit down to eat the same thing and actually like it, because we all experience food differently. But I suppose that's why for the cook it's such a gift, I suppose, because you're seeking to make those connections. And for me, that's incredibly important. Connection is everything. And I think that sometimes I read an awful lot about how social media stops people connecting from one another because we're on our screens or on our phones instead of talking to one another. And I think, God, these people don't get it. Social media is all about making connections, and that's exactly what it is. And for the cook, that's central to what we do.
So many of your recipes have this something extra. I'm thinking of the cardamom and the banana bread, or the star anise in the lamb and eggplant stew, that really have this sort of lingering, memorable flavor to them that I think sort of make them go beyond comfort food and into being not just comforting, but really interesting to eat, and that feels nourishing.
How do those things come to you?
You know, I think that I sometimes feel I think in spices and flavors, and that's very important to me. But I think I have to go backwards a step and say that for me, when I think of feel-good food or comfort food, I'm not thinking of the sort of food that's normally associated with this term. I'm not thinking of nostalgic, perhaps bland, stodgy fare. I'm thinking of food that uplifts me and makes me smile. So I think spices like texture, and I have a feel for the texture of food as I cook it, and the flavour is so important because it can make very basic ingredients feel transformed. You know, when I roast cauliflower and it's got a teeny bit of cinnamon and then harissa with chickpeas, somehow chickpeas and cauliflower are really the most basic ingredients, and then they taste magical. I can't take credit for it. It's the oven and it's the spices, but I do think it's quite important that we don't always think I have to get an ingredient that I've never heard of before in order to make this feel special. Sometimes thinking about how to cook cauliflower for the 109th time can make you come up with a recipe that you love so much more and that is more special in your life.
What do you do when something goes awry in the kitchen? Are there some troubleshooting strategies that you use to recover a recipe that's gone wrong?
I think, you know, mistakes are part of life and part of cooking. And if you're frightened of making a mistake, you're going to be incredibly inhibited. I am a very clumsy cook, so that I quite often slightly over-season, or I'm rushing about too fast and I put the wrong ingredient in. And sometimes the wrong ingredient turns out to be the right ingredient. I suppose that's like life, actually, is that sometimes mistakes happen for a reason, or if they don't happen for a reason, the way one rectifies them turns everything around. I think that, again, because I'm clumsy, perhaps most of my mistakes are cosmetic, in the sense that I take a cake out of a tin too soon and I break the cake. But then, you know, there's very little that a bit of powdered sugar and maybe some raspberries won't cure on the dessert front. I think the only mistake that I can't rectify is oversalting. So I tend to go pretty cautiously with salt and, you know, add so slowly. And having said that, that may be because I love salt and I put so much salt in my food that when I'm actually cooking it, I'm frightened that my own preference for salt will make me oversalt. So I go pretty undersalty, as it were, when I cook, because otherwise I'm frightened of what I'll do to people. In my defence, I have low blood pressure and I drink a lot of water, so I feel that it's very healthy for me to have a lot of salt.
If you have 3 or 5 friends coming for dinner, maybe a bit last minute, what are some of the go-to dishes that you rely on again and again?
So if I know people are coming for supper, then I might do a chicken, bitter orange and fennel tray bake, because that's incredibly easy. I can't carve very well, so using chicken thigh portions makes my life easier. And I just put everything in a plastic bag, a freezer bag, and put it out in the fridge, and then I just tip that out into an oven tray, and that's baked. And that's easy. And I suppose I go for kind of what I think of as DIY food, or indoor picnics. So I make an oven-baked chicken shawarma quite a lot. And I like that because I feel then I get in some flatbreads, maybe make a sort of yogurt sauce, some shredded lettuce. And I use the very unfashionable iceberg. I think sometimes one has to hold firm against trendiness. And I like that because I think it's very relaxing when you just have a few people around, that everyone's stretching across one another and making themselves kind of pockets stuffed with chicken and yogurt and pomegranate seeds. But if it's really last minute, then there's nothing ever wrong with this, an old-fashioned Italian pasta with garlic and olive oil and chili flakes. I think it doesn't really matter. You know, the thing is that if people come round, I just want to feed them. And I love cooking, but I also just love food. So good bread and good cheese is always, for me, a gorgeous option.
What advice do you give to young aspiring cooks who are trying to find their voice in the kitchen and maybe aren't sure yet of their own taste?
I think that there's only one really invaluable cook for yourself. I'm always stunned by the amount of people who never cook for themselves and then expect to be able to cope with a whole load of friends coming round. Because the thing about cooking for yourself is that you don't really mind so much if something goes wrong. So your shoulders drop a bit, you're not so tense, and then things don't go wrong. But you also learn about what your tastes are, what happens when you apply heat, what happens if you apply citrus, or you just learn about what cooking is. And I think that we're so fixated on confidence. Every book is about how to have confidence, but unless you have competence, you cannot have confidence. Competence is just really unglamorous, but it's essential. And you need to feel at ease in the kitchen by yourself before you can think of catering for other people. But I also would say is that just remember that people aren't judging you. Well, if they are judging you, then you shouldn't be friends with them.
Don't invite them back.
Don't invite them in the first place. Your friends are not there to judge you. Your friends can be honest. I mean, when I cook, when I'm testing out recipes, if I ask someone for their opinion, I don't want them to say, oh, it tastes great. I want them to say, you know what, I think maybe you've overdone the cinnamon. I want honesty, and no one should be upset by that. I would never go to someone's house and start acting as if I were a restaurant critic, you know, and thinking, this is wrong, that's wrong, this is right, this could be done better. And very few people are like that. So why do people think that's what other people are like when they come to our house? Cooking for people is a very generous act, and cooking for yourself is a very generous act. Both are equally important. So I think to try and separate cooking from this notion of judgment is essential. Otherwise, it's too inhibiting.
Thank you so much for coming to talk with us today.
I loved it. I probably spoke too much, but there it is. cook too much, I eat too much, I talk too much.
You can see a few of the recipes from Simply Nigella at quickanddirtytips.com/clevercookster. And don't forget to check out the fantastic new cookbook, Simply Nigella Feel Good Food. Tune in next time on The Clever Cookster for more tips and tricks from the kitchens of the world's best cooks.